Welcome to Canusa Street, a podcast at the intersection of the issues and policies between Canada and the United States. Here are your hosts, Beth Burke and Chris Sands.
Hello, and welcome back to Canusa Street. I am Beth Burke with the Canadian American Business Council, joined by my ever-fabulous co-host, Christopher Sands of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Hi, Chris. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Beth. I'm still not sure if I'm ever fabulous, but I'm working towards it. Every day and in every way, I'm getting better and better.
Well, I think you're fabulous, and I'm always pleased to see you on Canusa Street. And I'm really excited about today's episode. We have a friend joining us, and I would love to have you do a proper introduction.
Oh, well, I'm excited as well, because Jitunda Silva is, she's got it all. She has been a diplomat. She has been a policymaker, and she has been a really good friend of Canada-U.S. relations over a number of roles. Now, she was most recently CEO of the Canada Energy Regulator from 2020 to 2023, which is Canada's national regulator, energy regulator, responsible for regulating interprovincial and international pipelines and power lines to ensure that they operate safely and efficiently. So that's the connection with the United States and the connections across Canada, which is quite important. In that role, she's both protecting the environment, advancing reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, and trying to provide relevant and timely energy data and analysis for those of us in the nerd world to use, which is great. Now, from 2016 to 2019, she was here in Washington serving as Alberta's senior representative to the United States, based as they are out of the Canadian Embassy here in Washington, D.C., and served as Alberta's Deputy Minister for International and Intergovernmental Relations from 2013 to 2019. Before all of that, and before she joined the Alberta Public Service, Jitunda spent 12 years in Canada's Foreign Service as a specialist in Canada-U.S. relations. She was Consul General in Chicago, Deputy Head of the Agency at Status of Women Canada, and Director General of the APEC Women and the Economy Summit, where she worked with women around the world on issues of leadership and women's economic empowerment. That actually earned her in 2013 the International Alliance for Women World of Difference Award, and she makes a world of difference everywhere she is. Jitunda Silva, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for that very kind introduction. You almost made me blush.
Well, oh, I didn't even add that you're also a global fellow at the Wilson Center, so that's a new thing, but we're really glad to have you.
I'm very excited about that. Thanks so much for inviting me.
And it is such an impressive and unique resume. You are one of the few people I know who has served both representing the federal and provincial government in the United States. And I would love to start there. Could you dive in and tell us sort of what your experience was like and, you know, compare and contrast representing both levels of government here?
Yeah, it was all wonderful. All exciting, some of it a little bit crazy, but, you know, it really is an honor and a privilege to represent either your province or your country abroad. So I would say that, you know, as a federal representative, your job is to represent all of Canada, right? And so you're representing maybe the city of Winnipeg one day, and then the province of Prince Edward Island another, and then some federal initiative in between, whereas with the province, obviously, you have a narrower scope of interest, and sometimes your provincial interest doesn't entirely align with the federal government or that of other provinces. But I would say when you represent a province, you have a different relationship with the U.S. states, which is hugely important to Canada. And I think that as a province, you can speak to the states about the issues that where you have shared jurisdiction, right? And so if you're looking to do something, for example, around labor mobility, you know, that's very much a state issue, or you're looking at, you know, other sort of more local things. You really have this opportunity to share your experience, share best practices, and learn from each other. And I know that the Canadian provinces and U.S. states have done lots of things. I know Alberta had MOUs with various U.S. states. I just saw that actually recently Alberta signed another MOU. I think it was maybe with Nevada. But lots of great stuff going on. Like I used to work on unmanned aerial vehicles, you know, that type of thing. So it really does span the whole range of issues, both economic and policy. But I would say it was all great and all fun. And when I was at the embassy the last time as Alberta's representative, I had a great working relationship with the then ambassador, Dave McNaughton. And we had the ability to sort of hand off on things. You know, if it was something where Alberta had more influence or greater connections, then, you know, they'd ask me to work on that. And if it's somewhere where the federal government had was more appropriate that they take the lead, then we'd feed in our information, but we worked really well together. So I'm, for one, a big fan of the Canadian provinces having representation in the United States.
Yeah, and I just have a quick follow-up and then I'll let you hop in, Chris. I feel like, you know, it's, you touched on the relationships between the province and the states, and I think we've talked about this here on Canusa Street before, but I think there's a little bit of a, maybe a knowledge gap on the U.S. side, fully appreciating the reach and control that the provinces have of their resources. So while it is province to state has a unique relationship, you still have a federal overlay, right? As a province having control of the resources, and especially in the energy space that you've had so much, you know, experience in. So how did that dynamic come to play? You know, like the overlay of the provincial federal relationship.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because in Canada, the provinces have jurisdiction over, they right. own the resource. So they are responsible for developing that resource. But where the federal government steps in is if they want that resource, say, to leave Canada by way of pipeline or transmission line, right? And so it's great to be able to produce a resource, but if you can't get it to market, you know, and you don't have, and Canada produces way more energy than we consume, right? Much to the benefit of the United States. So you do need to work together, right, in terms of making sure that you're coordinating that development side, that extraction side, and then how you actually get it to market. So it's important that the federal government understand what the province's priorities are. And it gets tricky in certain situations. This happens in the U.S. as well, where certain governors have a different political bent or priority than the president. This happens in Canada very regularly and leads to some very interesting conversations. But you know, at the end of the day, those provincial exports contribute greatly to Canada's GDP. And so it's important that they find ways of working together and promoting the opportunities that exist all across the country.
Well, if I can follow up on that, there's an interesting area of the overlap which relates to Indigenous peoples. Many of Canada's Indigenous peoples have a connection to the federal government. The federal government has historic relationships and obligations to those communities that come from that early colonial settler period and how all of that was mediated. And yet, with energy projects, there are some provinces where land claims aren't settled. There's a complex interplay of federal and provincial in dealing with Indigenous communities. How did you find that? And I know there's some been historical challenges. People here will remember in the United States hearing about Indigenous protests that were blocking rail lines and trying to stop projects. But how has that evolved now? And is the relationship now between Indigenous peoples and, say, energy projects with the federal and provincial governments a bit better or still a long way to go?
Yeah, it's a great question, Chris, and one that's quite complicated. And for those who are interested in learning more, I would suggest actually the University of Alberta has an amazing online free course about understanding Canada's history, the history of Canada's Indigenous peoples, and how we came from where early settlers, as you say, or colonizers to where we are now. I mean, ultimately, the responsibility, the treaties that were signed between Indigenous peoples and the federal government, right? And so in Canada, we refer to that the federal government is the crown. And the federal government has an obligation to, they say, uphold the honor of the crown. So those treaties are still valid. They're still legally binding. There are obligations that the federal government, for which the federal government is responsible. And the federal government is required to undertake what's called meaningful consultation with Indigenous peoples and then provide accommodations where treaty rights are infringed. So even in provinces where treaties aren't settled, that's ultimately a conversation with the federal government. It is complicated, though, because the provinces also play a role. The provinces are also referred to as the crown in Canada, and there are federal crown lands and provincial crown lands, and so it all just gets very complicated. But ultimately, the final authority rests with the federal government, and there has been a big push since the current Liberal government was elected to actually adopt the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in Canada and make that legislation, which has been done. And so an action plan has been developed and various parts of the government are working to move forward with that, to make sure that Indigenous rights are respected, that treaty rights are upheld, and that we work together. I think that regardless of your political views, people understand that the world has changed Indigenous peoples in Canada, at least their rights are being more and more recognized, and where you don't work together, you will encounter challenges, as you mentioned, blockades of rail lines and things like that. And so if you want to have a project developed, then you need to work with Indigenous peoples. You need to engage them early on. We're increasingly seeing in Canada equity partnerships as well, where companies, and not the governments, but companies are directly entering into agreements with local Indigenous nations to have them have an equity stake in that project. We often see other things like what we call impact benefit agreements. So there's the promise of jobs or economic opportunities, other things. So that really that idea that a rising tide raises all boats, right? That part of this effort in Canada around reconciliation is not only understanding first the truth of our history and promising to do better going forward, but also to provide economic, to allow, to enable, to encourage economic opportunities for Indigenous peoples as well. So that's a non-answer to your short question probably, but it is very complicated. But I'm very pleased to see, I think we're making very positive progress in Canada. I think that both the federal government, provincial governments, and industry are seeing the positive benefits of working respectfully, upholding treaty rights, and really engaging meaningfully with Indigenous peoples. We're seeing a lot of very positive outcomes, and we're seeing projects like they get built, which is what I think most people want to see. So very positive overall. Still lots of work to do, but very positive.
I should stipulate that permitting and building big infrastructure projects is a headache in the U.S. as well. So not casting any aspersions, but while you were Canada Energy Regulator, the Supreme Court of Canada struck down the Impact Assessment Act of 2017, which was an attempt, I think, sincere attempt to try to find a way to take those voices and take Indigenous voices in and give them a voice in a process of approving projects. What was your sense of where we are now after the Supreme Court decision? Are we back on a good track, or are we dealing, dealing possibly in an uncertain period because we've sort of lost the process that we thought we had?
Mm-hmm. Well, the most recent Supreme Court decision around the Impact Assessment Act was actually really around provincial rights and jurisdictions, right? So previous Supreme Court decisions, if you looked at, say, Trans Mountain Pipeline and that Supreme Court challenge, that had to do with Indigenous rights and whether consultations were meaningful and the accommodations were adequate. And the Supreme Court ruled that no, the federal government had not upheld the honor of the Crown. So a certain part of the process had to be redone. On the impact assessment front, it really had to do with whether the federal government had overreached. And the Supreme Court said, yes, it had. It had stepped into areas of provincial jurisdiction. And so the federal government is looking at that, and they've made commitments. They said that they will be making changes to that legislation to have it better align with federal jurisdiction. So it's things like some of the things that were questioned were in that legislation. The federal government had the authority to elevate a project. So as happens in the U.S., certain things are reviewed by states, certain things are reviewed by the federal government. Sometimes they both want to take a look at them. But what was happening is, depending on the size of the project, that legislation gave the federal government the authority, the Minister of the Environment and Climate Change, to say, I'm going to designate this project and it will be federally regulated. And so that's somewhere that the Supreme Court said, no, in fact, because resource development is under the purview of the provinces, that part of the legislation needs to be amended. And I think I've seen recently comments from the Minister of Energy and Natural Resources in Canada that the government is looking to move ahead on that. And I think there is a great desire to provide certainty soon, as with certainty comes investment. And with investment, you get more projects in the pipeline, so to speak. And that's what people are looking for, especially with a commitment to move towards net zero.
But we fall back to what we had before, which are provincial regulators that are at least looking at projects. It's not anarchy.
Oh, no. Canada, we're all about peace, order, and good government. Never anarchy.
Well, you touched briefly, well, maybe not briefly, but we talked a little bit about the Indigenous consultation and buy-in from, you know, corporations and agreements that are being made. And I feel like, you know, Canada is a little bit further ahead than the US on this front. And, you know, I actually just been having a bunch of conversations on Capitol Hill in DC about this, even this week, talking about how do we, as you know, the US, look at these opportunities to do research, resource development, and move forward on sort of the next phase of energy in the critical mineral space. Like, where do you see that relationship going, and where do you see opportunities for U.S. and Canada to really collaborate?
Around Indigenous rights or around critical?
Either or both.
Well, I think it's been interesting to me watching and having worked, you know, much of my career in the U.S. and almost all of it on Canada-U.S. issues. We have seen recently in the U.S. a few more court cases ruling in favor of U.S. tribes. So if we look at, Enbridge's Line 5, for example, right, you've seen examples there or Enbridge infrastructure where courts have ruled that, you know, tribes have taken, they're pursuing the legal route now, perhaps seeing the success that their Canadian counterparts have had. And so they've taken their concerns to court and courts are ruling saying, yes, in fact, you know, the site of this pipeline needs to be fixed or a greater economic opportunity needs to be provided. And so I think there is an opportunity. Of course, the history of Indigenous peoples in Canada, the U.S. and the colonization is different. The treaty situation is different, but I think there is opportunity. And there's, in fact, lots of nations that straddle the border. So yep. There's the opportunity for governments to better understand each other, but also for those peoples to work together and advocate. And we're seeing that, certainly. We're seeing, leaders from Canada travel to the U.S. and vice versa to have those conversations. I think on the critical minerals front, I mean, what's interesting to me is I was thinking about preparing for this conversation is, you know, how I've seen the Canada-U.S. energy relationship. And if you define energy broadly to include those minerals that will be required to power electric vehicles or whatever the case may be, you know, that with, I think, the tragedy that was 9/11 and sort of the focus on what was then called the Fortress North America. I'm dating myself going back all that time. But, you know, there was this shift from this, you know, we'll always get our energy from the Middle East to we really should be more self-sufficient. And then the development starting really with Canada's Alberta's oil sands and the understanding that there was this opportunity for North America to be an energy superpower. And then the challenges we've seen with cross-border infrastructure. I think that that conversation around how North America can be an economic superpower, right? And if we as North America want to be leaders in the energy of tomorrow. So if you look at what's happening in China and the efforts through the U.S. IRA to really onshore a lot of that production and compete directly with China on solar panels and electrical vehicles and things like that, I think we have to remember that we are stronger together as North America. And I always thought it was interesting that the U.S. counted Canada's oil production as domestic. Like if you look at the statistics, they consider it because we are so intertwined, right? And so I think that rather than compete with one another on something like critical minerals, because our industries are so integrated, whether it's autos or energy refinery or whatever the case may be, to actually have that strategic conversation, which is very hard, I think, post-COVID, when we all looked at, okay, what do we need to do to keep our own country safe? And then where you have an ongoing conversation in the U.S., I think, around trade and protectionism, right? That really, I think, came to the fore under President Trump's presidency with a focus on Make America Great Again, but certainly see President Biden as well making a lot of comments about the need to increase U.S. domestic production. So how do you have that conversation in a way where it's, you know, maybe you don't want to say North American, but for whatever political reason, but how are you looking at how Canada fits into this and how we really are stronger together? Because that's proven true for so many industries over time. So how do we protect that special and unique relationship given the political dynamics we're seeing on both sides of the border, I think is a question a lot of people are pondering these days.
That's amazing. And one of the things that's also now on our bilateral agenda, because it's in the USMCA and it's been echoed in the roadmap for renewed US-Canada partnership and even in the North American Leaders Summit agendas, is a commitment on the part of the Biden administration and the Trudeau government on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and trying to make sure there are more people participating in trade, more people participating in decision-making across our societies. And that priority for inclusiveness and diversity, you see it reflected in different ways. But in your experience, I know you've worked in quite a number of high profile roles looking at women's economic empowerment. And that's obviously a priority for both governments. How are we doing? And what more could we do? Are there some areas where, you know, just in your experience, you think we really are missing an opportunity to get the benefit of all of our citizens and even maybe the benefit of women's leadership in some of these areas of the economy, and especially energy, where it's a lot of engineers and there's kind of a male culture default that we've had over a lot of decades?
Yeah, great question, Chris, and certainly another complex one. I mean,
I specialize in those, as Beth knows.
No, but we just had International Women's Day, so certainly something that I've been thinking out. I just saw a stat actually that Canada had fallen from 10th to 14th place in terms of representation of women in elected positions. So I think that, you know, there's so many factors at play here. I think we hear a lot about the toxicity of elected life or public life, not only in Canada. You're seeing it there in the US as well, with people deciding whether or not they're going to run again and making comments about, you know, just the tone and tenor of the debate. I think it's very hard to be in the public arena these days, right? And unfortunately, it is even harder for women. Women are still judged by different standards. You know, I've had comments made over the course of my career about, you know, my appearance or the tone of my voice, things that men never encounter. And so I think there's still work to be done there. That said, we have made tremendous progress. Like when I started out, I was often the only woman in the room, and now there's a few more, which I think is wonderful. So I do really believe in the, if you can see it, you can be it. So I think it is wonderful. We're seeing more women in positions of leadership. I am a huge believer in allyship and sponsorship. So I was just reading a quote by the late Toni Morrison about how if you are free, it is your job to free others. And so I say, when you walk into a room, you can choose to use your hands to pull the door closed behind you, or you can choose to use your hands to pull someone through with you. And you need to pull someone through with you. The more people we pull through, the more other, it's this domino effect, right? And so I think it's keeping up the good fight. I think it's continuing to have conversations. I think it's also very hard. I mean, on one hand, you need for inclusion in order for transitions to be successful. You will not successfully transition the economy from a fossil fuel-based energy system to a renewable energy system if people are worried about their jobs and their homes, because they're thinking, I work at a refinery, what am I going to do, right? So you need to have these conversations. And I think that is a part of the IRA that I hope succeeds regardless of the outcome of your election in the fall, is, you know, this focus on job retraining, this real focus on people who would otherwise be left behind, right?
You mentioned the IRA. What does it mean?
So that's the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. Funding in there, right, to promote the transition to clean energy projects, both for getting things built and transitioning the workforce. And you also have to understand that the pace of change may not be as quick as someone might like. Like when I look at my kids and I tell them, I have two daughters, that it'll be 200 years before there's gender equity. Like that's a real conversation to have, right? But on the other hand, you need to move. If you move too quickly, there is a backlash. And we've seen that in any number of issues, right? But I don't think that should stop people from moving forward. And I think that where I see successes are, you know, women or people from equity deserving groups who are in positions of power, who are continuing to act as allies and sponsors. You know, I think there's a lot, like in Calgary, we have a Young Women in Energy organization, which I think is tremendous. You are seeing more and more women in these jobs. But I also think, too, it'll be interesting for me to see how the workplace has permanently changed as a result of COVID and people working from home. I think that there's a generational shift happening and a post-COVID shift happening, too, right? Where people don't want to be in the office. The majority of people want to be in the office some of the time and work from home some of the time, right? And so how do you adapt to that? And I think that given that women are still primary caregivers, by and large, right? More women do that than men, whether it's from the children or aging parents or whatever the case may be. I think that allowing for that flexibility also allows for women and other people that don't fit inside the box maybe to take on those positions and to do them in a different way. And so I am hopeful. I continue to see forward progress, maybe not at the pace that I would like, but we are making progress. We just have to keep pushing.
No, I mean, I think it's just so important that we continue to hit on these opportunities for women and for, you know, underrepresented folks. And I just am so glad to hear you be hopeful, because some days it's harder than others. And I'm with you, right? Like, I think it's just so important that we continue to raise all the voices to the table. So I just wanted to echo that and kind of pull up my hope instead of, you know, can sometimes go to despair places. But right now, I think hopeful is the better place to be. So Thank you for that.
But I have to say, like, as the parent of teenagers, both of my kids are in sports. And it's fascinating to me. I mean, I didn't play sports. Reading was my sport when I was in school. But for my kids who played sports, for my friends who played sports, there was, you know, girls drift away at a certain age, right? They just drift away. But now there's a real concerted effort to keep women in sport, right? And I was at a sporting event with one of my kids, and there was a women-only event, and all the referees were women, and all the coaches were women, and they actually took a picture because it was a really big deal the first time that it happened. And I do think there are life lessons you learn from sport. Now I'm wishing that I did something other than read in high school, but there are, watching my kids, there are these important life lessons, right, about how you lose and you pick yourself up again and working as a team and all this stuff that helps you later in life. And I think helps you in positions of leadership, right? And so I am hopeful for reasons like that, right, where there's actual concerted efforts in sport to keep girls in, and understanding that, you know, while some are hugely competitive, some are playing for the social element, but the skills they're learning, both in terms of their athleticism and how to advocate for themselves, all those things are important later in life. So I think that where we're seeing it outside the workplace will hopefully help us inside the workplace and help us as a society as a whole. So yes, we'll remain hopeful together.
Great.
Well, that's one of the great divides. Another one, though, if you could just comment, I mean, it's dangerous territory, is Canadian unity. And it's a funny thing that there are places like Alberta and Saskatchewan where we're talking mainly about oil and gas in the energy space. And then you get places like Quebec and Manitoba and even BC that are focusing on things like hydroelectricity. There are some mixed messages on hydrogen and where it may come from. How's Canada's unity on energy? I mean, how do you bridge those divides? I mean, obviously, when you're the Canada Energy Regulator, you oversee all of that, or at least you have a window on all of that. Can Canadians unite around this idea of powering the world and certainly powering the U.S. market and say, even if it's in different ways, we're working together? Or is that rivalry, maybe sibling rivalry among the provinces with different energy solutions, likely to be a permanent feature for some time to come?
Oh my goodness. You really don't shy away from the tricky questions. So I would say, Canadian provinces and territories have jurisdiction over the resources, and they have chosen to develop different resources, right? I live in the province of Alberta. Alberta is blessed with an abundance of resources. So we have chosen to develop our oil and gas. We also have some hydro, not the same scale as Quebec or Manitoba, for example, but there's tremendous potential. It is always sunny. Here in Calgary, it is sunny on average 330 days a year. So tremendous solar potential. And there's parts of this province where the wind always blows, right? So it's a question of policy in terms of which resources provinces have chosen to develop. And every province has made their own choice. And that is the wonder of Canada's constitution. I think where things get tricky, as gets tricky in the United States, is questions around interconnectedness. Right. So as we look to build out our grid, as we look to electrify our economy and our country, the overwhelming majority of electrical infrastructure in Canada is provincially regulated. And we don't have an east-west grid. We have a north-south grid. We have built out our electricity grid to sell into the United States, right? And at times import from the US, if you look at sort of Washington State and British Columbia, or the West Coast and the East Coast. I think not only in Canada, but in the United States, building infrastructure is increasingly challenging, and not just energy infrastructure. You could be looking to build, I don't know, an aircraft manufacturing facility, for example, or a new ring road in a city, extra rail lines. All of that is hard, right? Because people are more engaged and they want to have their say. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try to do it. And so part of the conversation that's happening in Canada right now, because we here in Canada have a price on carbon, right? That is federally legislated by our federal government, and that price is going up on the 1st of April. And with that desire to transition to a low carbon economy coming up very quickly, very readily against affordability questions, how do you transition your electricity system in a way where it is affordable and reliable? Because I always say we are two generations removed from energy scarcity right now. My grandparents lived through the Great Depression. They fought in the World War II. They knew how to survive. My mom grew up on a farm in rural Nova Scotia. She also knew how to survive if the power went out. I have bits of that because I grew up with that. My kids, they're used to having the power of the world in the palm of their hand and their cell phone, right? And if you can't charge it, it's just a very different reality, right? So how do you make that transition without brownouts or lack of energy, or so you can't charge all of your devices, right? And so that requires a different conversation in Canada than we've had. It's one that people are trying to have, but it always gets tricky, right? Because there are questions of jurisdiction, there are questions of politics. I think, yes, to answer your basic question, all of Canadians can get behind the idea that we are an energy superpower and we have the ability to fuel the world. I think it gets tricky as to where that power is leaving the country. Is it an LNG port, right? Is it more international transmission lines? Is it pipelines? I think all of that gets tricky, right? Because it gets very local and very real for people. But it's conversations that have they have to be had, and they are challenging because they are complex. The whole system is interconnected, and so you need to understand the domino effect, but it's hard for people sometimes to invest the time needed to actually understand that complexity. And so how can we make that easier for people to facilitate these conversations, I think, is a question for policymakers.
And you've tapped into something, and I just wanted to highlight it. You know, the U.S. is Canada's big energy customer, but we drive a hard bargain. And in some cases, you get a little bit less than you might get, say, elsewhere, because all the infrastructure, or so much of it, does come to the U.S. But with the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion coming on stream, potentially LNG Canada, greater exports on the West Coast, there are other projects I know that are in the works. How do you think Canada becoming an energy supplier to the Europeans, to the Japanese, to the South Koreans and other allies, particularly those that have been relying on Russia or another, we'll just call them a bad actor. This is a whole other debate. How do you see that expansion growing? And does it come at the expense of the relationship with the U.S., or is it U.S. relationship plus in your view?
Well, I think it's important to point out that while Canada was greatly increasing its energy production, so too was the United States, right? If you look at the many years while the debate over Keystone XL pipeline was happening, the U.S. basically doubled its domestic pipeline infrastructure and greatly increased both its oil and gas production, right? So I don't think it's an either or. I think that it's also important to point out that these commodities are globally traded. So once an electron or a molecule hits a coast, it will go where someone wants to buy it. So the oil that's shipped on Trans Mountain could go to China or it could go to California to be refined. We don't know. But what's important for Canada is having that tidewater access means access to global prices, right? So I really don't think it's an either or. I think there is tremendous potential for North America to help Europe decrease its dependence on oil from Russia, from natural gas from Russia. I think there you keep running into the same series of questions, right? If you've got climate change, believing that that's an existential threat, are you shifting your reliance to a different supplier of oil or natural gas, or are you trying to make that great leap straight to electrification, right? And I think for people, if they're feeling the cold in the dark, they just want energy now, right? So how do you put those systems in place? And it is hard because geopolitics is confronting environmental policies, is confronting affordability, right? These are very complex times right now. The world is not does not seem overly straightforward, but I think there is potential there for both Canada and the U.S. to help Europe, for sure.
Well, thank you so much. I know we really appreciate all of your time, expertise, and insights. So thank you so much for joining us here on Canusa Street. We would love to have you back anytime. The water's warm here now that we did the tough questions, right? We can just talk about the happy, uplifting stuff.
Well, thanks, Beth. We didn't even get to talk about our mutual love of the Wisconsin State Fair, so I'll have to come back.
Yes. Fried Snickers and all the good
Pig
things.
Big races.
Exactly right. I love it.
Well, Jitan, that's one of the reasons that you're such a good visitor to Canusa Street, because you appreciate both sides of the street, and not just the big policy, but the very human level activity. So it's been great to have you. Thanks again.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you both.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by the Canadian American Business Council and the Wilson Center. If you like this episode, help others find our show and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.